I'm Christopher Leiden with the historian Martin Marty, considering the modern martyr Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who would surely be a saint by now if Protestant churches canonized the most radiant stars in their sky. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about a man and a life that have come to stand for maybe the toughest questions that came out of the 20th century, like, where were the German Christians? Where was God when Hitler very nearly turned out the lights of civilization in the 1930s and 40s? Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a defiant Lutheran priest who became part of a plot to assassinate Hitler as World War II began. It was in his prison letters and diaries before his own execution that Bonhoeffer raised the blunt questions that still resonate. Honest to God, as Bonhoeffer put it, who is Christ actually for us today? Or who is in charge for believers and non-believers when God seems to have gone missing? Martin Marty, I've been reading you forever. I'm grateful for your Bonhoeffer book. I'm grateful just to hear you on Open Source, finally. I wish you'd begin with the personal before we get to the theological stuff of the story. You've been consumed with Bonhoeffer issues for 50 years since his prison papers were first published. What is this story about for you?
I was a seminarian, a Lutheran, and therefore the same communion at Bonhoeffer. And we seminarians in the 50s were very lonely when we were looking for any guidance and heroic company out of the totalitarian traumas of the 20th century. There are tens of millions of Catholics and Lutherans in Germany. There were tens of thousands of priests and ministers, and yet we can list on fingers of one hand the people who stood out above, who went to their death explicitly in opposition to Hitler and in some cases for defense of Jews. They were so rare. And then along came, I had classmates who had been studying in Germany, and they came back with a little book called Widerstand und Ergebung. I had to look up those German words. It meant, when do you stand against something and when do you submit? It just was something we just passed around and leaped at in the first 10 years or so after the war.
He's a cult by now. And I keep wondering, what is it that gives him staying power, not just as an anti-fascist hero or a self-sacrificing Christian, but as a provocateur, as a thinker for all time?
Well, I'm glad you asked that way, because he wouldn't be around if it were just the heroism and the witness. There are purer ones than he. My own favorite was a pastor named Paul Schneider, just like a priest or minister down the block. You don't expect anything from them. And he stood up against Hitler very early and more firmly than Bonhoeffer did. Bonhoeffer was kind of an aristocrat. He had protection. Whereas Paul Schneider, they put him in prison. He preached out the window. They warned him and so on, and they killed him very early in all this. There are several like that. But Bonhoeffer backed it up because he had one of the most original theological minds of his generation. He just had a hungry mind and put together in fresh way. And I think that people who've read him devotionally, as some do, he's on greeting cards and other things, did that. You mentioned there's a kind of a cult. I think there was a cult of Bonhoeffer. And that sort of fell apart because we get tired of things. We're now in a stage where scholarly interests are very strong and new attempts to apply him. He was a very big resource in South Africa's struggles against apartheid, for example. And there's an interesting mix. Mandela's a great hero, but he thought interesting things. Martin Luther King, I can't ever get over it, that King and Bonhoeffer both died at age 39. They had to have something to say. You can't just to endure in many cultures. You can't just say something interesting. You have to back it up with profound thought.
This is one of those men to whom everything happens, and he made these curious connections intellectually or imaginatively, intuitively, with Gandhi, for example. I keep being reminded in his sort of stubborn cheerfulness of Anne Frank. But there's a specifically African-American connection through the Union theological years when he was living in Harlem and made a profound connection with the spirit of African-American Christianity. Would you explain that?
Well, we have to begin by realizing that in the American churches of the time when he was here, 1931, there was no contact at all. There were African-American seminaries and colleges. But for Bonhoeffer to come over during a one-year scholarship, when he has all this to learn and can look at anything in America, chooses to pass up the great big cathedrals and the great big Fifth Avenue churches, and makes his way to actually a great big Abyssinian Baptist church in Harlem. Adam Clayton Powell Sr. was the pastor. And his best friend was a young seminarian, Fred Fisher. So that kind of inquiring mind, what could he learn? And I think that stayed in his interpretation of the Bible. Maybe I'll give an illustration again using Martin Luther King and other people. Somebody said, paraphrasing him, that the Bible is an unfinished book and you're in it. And in a sense, that's what he always would do. He didn't say there was an interesting thing 3,000 years ago. He'd say, there's the Jordan and we haven't crossed, or there are the mountains. I've seen the mountains and so on. You were in the plot. And I think that's what Bonhoeffer picked up partly from those churches. You weren't a passive bystander.
Can I just say about the Harlem connection? It reminds me a little bit of 50 years earlier, Anton Dvorak, in the great tradition of German composition, came to New York and lived a few years and pronounced this famous prediction that African-American blues and spirituals and gospel music, what was becoming jazz, would be the future of Western music. And it rings truer today than ever. But here's Bonhoeffer, too, somehow finding the future where Americans at the time hadn't seen it.
Well, I think they were looking for and discerning and finding and making something of, to use a word that needs some defining, soul, as in soul music and so on. One definition of soul that comes from Aristotle by a lot of other people is that soul is not a ghost in the machine. It's not a pilot on a ship. It's not Casper the Ghost is Spooky. If you see the hand of someone who was alive yesterday, all the corpuscles are there, but something's missing. What had been there, one scholar calls it, the integrated, vital power of any organic body. That's what these people heard. Well, the Jewish white composers like Gershwin, how did they catch on so fast? They were looking for precisely this kind of thing, and we still call it soul music. He learned to find that in preaching. But he also never turned against the high culture, which he came a part of. When you read his books about how they worship when they're in a seminary hiding from Hitler, they draw upon worship and music from all the ages. Many of his prison letters and writings will be comment on the latest modern composer or medieval. Medieval music was the Gregorian, which we used to hear in the Catholic churches here. He once said, "You have no right to engage in or a Gregorian chant unless you have spoken up for the Jews." Well, again, you didn't bring those worlds together in the Germany of pre-Hitler and then Hitler, but he was looking for soul.
He's a holy man with German intellectual rigor, also with a tremendous decisive toughness when it mattered, and a personal sweetness, even at the gallows. I mean, is he for you? Can you picture him as one man?
Yes, I can, because I think he had that integrative power of soul. I think he'd be embarrassed to hear you say that he was a holy man. Bonhoeffer was on many levels very worldly. He loved the high life. He loved good food, good drink, good company, obviously good music most of all. He wasn't the kind that you'd follow around in the way you usually think of a saint. But I think he was a spiritual leader. This seminary had hiding from Hitler was on the sand dunes near the Baltic Sea in old farm buildings. Why did 27 seminarians desert universities and come out there to study with him? By the way, a few years later, almost all of them were killed in the German-Russian war. They were all drafted. He did all he could to keep them out of it, but they were in there. And I have seen his records in which he says, "Gefallen, gefallen, gefallen." They'd fallen in battle. So these were not groupies that had to have something spooky going on. They were full-blooded people, and I think he was too. So trying to discern the secret of people like this is always the hardest thing we do. But one thing a leader does, it takes steps at high risk. at the theological schools, they used to call it the word the hermeneutics of testimony, which means hermeneutics is interpretation. And if you have something at stake, you're going to be paid attention to it in a different way. I think we all paid attention. I knew Martin Luther King somewhat, and I don't know why it was, but I think everybody I knew pictured that he isn't going to live a full life. Someday, somebody's going to get him. We didn't know what direction or whatever, but you know it was there. And therefore, what he said had to be measured. He said some trivial things. He said some drivel, I suppose. He often was pretty far from the scene, and yet you're paying attention. Gandhi was the same thing. Certainly Mandela, 27 years in that prison. He could read out of the phone book, and I want to be there. And I think that's what happened with Bonhoeffer. But unlike most such people, he came through with stuff which scholars, I have a full volume bibliography of his, and the computers are just busy analyzing it.
Martin Marty, can we save Dietrich Bonhoeffer from some of his bumper stickers, or maybe just unfold them? Some of them book titles, The Cost of Discipleship, for example, which you wrote in the 30s, relatively early. What did he mean by the cost of discipleship? What did he mean in disparaging cheap grace?
Okay. Well, when he was writing, of course, men wrote about men, meaning people. And his most famous line in Cost of Discipleship, again, the shadow of Hitler coming over him, says, when Jesus Christ calls a man, he calls him to die. Now, he didn't mean that everybody who follows is going to be beat up and killed the way he was, but he did mean that if you take the Sermon on the Mount, on which that book is based, again and again, you'd hear the word of Jesus saying, you might have to leave your father and your mother. You might have to leave your friends. You have to leave the tax tables. You have to leave all those things and move ahead. And Bonhoeffer translated that now into the modern world and modern language. And I think anticipating what's going to happen to so many people in Germany, but also in Russia and the whole world, a lot of people died. I've heard figures in the Soviet Union of how many Orthodox and Catholic priests were killed. It runs in the thousands. And they could have gone some other direction. They could have lied. They could have hidden. They could have done all these things, but they stayed at their posts. And I think that's part of what he was doing. And so he says, but it's costly. He believed very much in divine grace. God is a loving God who dispenses good to us. But you don't get there by cheapening it. When Bonhoeffer looks out on a church that's very complacent, and I think one reason the book is so popular in many cultures, including here, is that you can settle back with your rituals and your practices and your big buildings and customs and prayers, and you think of it all figured out. And in the process, you've cheapened grace. And so when it comes, you won't even recognize it because there's no price at all.
What did he mean by a world come of age? And what did he also mean, it's related, by the death of religion, or Christianity without religion?
Okay. Well, you're getting right to the heart of the tough stuff. So much of what he did, you could just read right away and figure it out. Which one did you want first?
A world come of age.
Well, yeah, that's a good one. The German word was Mündigkeit, the adulthood of the world. He pictured that the world of Europe and America, and that's really what he was mainly talking about, had been adolescent. And the way it related to God was the way children do. You bargain with God. You want to get to heaven and hell. God's going to whip you on the fingers if not. You have all these ways of softening it up along the way. And then he said, as I look out now, since the Enlightenment of the 18th century, people don't need that God anymore. I remember once being on a program with Dick Gregory, the black comic, who said, my world really changed because when I was little, they told me that noise of thunder was God hurling thunderbolts. Whether you were Greek or whether you were Jew or Christian, it didn't make any difference. God was throwing those things. And then I just found out that it was the electric spark that went from one cloud to another. It could never put it together again. But Bonhoeffer says that's sort of what has happened to people of the West. They developed the great universities, modern medicine. You're constantly subjecting mystery to skepticism and criticism, and you're living a pretty good life. When he saw what Nazism did to it, he saw Nazism not as the world come of age, but as the birth of a new demonic religion. That's why it had power. Hmm. But when he'd get into his father's psychiatric lab and the doctors his father hung out with, his brother-in-law is a Jewish lawyer, as he deals with all these, they could be very reverent and very respectful, but they didn't need God to provide the explanations and answers. And Bonhoeffer says, let's see that not as all loss. A lot of people believed that and got into superstition and imprisoning others, if you will, mentally. I have to admit that the World Come of Age is one of the most problematic ones for me because are we sure that's what happened? Selectively, it certainly did. Western Europe, boy, it's hard even to bring up the subject of God. Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Germany, well, for that matter, the Catholic countries too, of Italy and Spain. Church attendance will be, the Pope will come to America and bawl out the Catholics that only 45% of them were at Mass last Sunday. He can go back to Italy and maybe 7% were.
Yeah.
In England, they said you go to church to be hatched, matched, and dispatched. If you're a prince, you have to get married in church, but that's about it. But he said they're getting along pretty well. They have good literature. They have good poetry. They have good music. They eat well, all these things. And when I look out in the world as talk about the world, I'd have to say, well, that's just one little precinct of the world called North America and Western Europe, because the world out there is very different and it's very religious. The northern world, of which we're a part, lost 3,000 Christians in the last 24 hours. The southern world, sub-Saharan Africa, alone gained 18,000 new Christians in the last 24 hours.
Mm.
And that's not a cold, impassive, cut-and-dried Christianity. They jump up and down. They really believe it's all happening. And if you would add up the power of Islam, 50 years ago, every seventh person in the world was Muslim. Today, every fourth or fifth is. Buddhism has come back. Hinduism has come back. And selectively, Christianity has. The largest Christian clump in the world today is Latin America, South and Central America.
So what did Bonhoeffer mean by Christianity without religion?
Okay, but that's exactly logically next. If the world has come this way, should Christianity think that in order to preach the message of grace, of the love of God, for him the big question is the meaning of Christ, for all that, do you have to drag him back into medieval superstition and spookiness? No. He thought that there were many things about Christianity that we would do better without. Too many laws, and they obscured the message of grace. Too many do-I-dares, timidity. Too many prerequisites. Yes, you can come to my church if you're straight, but not if you're gay. All of these rules and things, he thought, didn't have much to do with the good news of what God is doing. And he said, you could trim it down. Mm-hmm. And so then he had to ask the question, okay, who is this Christ? And the formula he came up with, that's the third of his. First was the one, the world come of age. The second one is religionless Christianity. And then the third one is Jesus Christ as the man for others. He didn't ever question the what Christians call the deity of Christ, but he wasn't a bit interested in Christ surrounded by angels in some nether region. For him, Christ was where he met it in the church in the streets of South Harlem or in Barcelona or in London along the way. And finding Christ in the Germany of his day was hard because they had all the words right and none of the spirit. So I think those are the three main formulae. And then he adds one more that I give a couple pages to. He didn't get time to develop. You have to remember that these letters that made up this book were being written in the months when he is sent to his final prison and then to death. But he noticed that in the early church there was something they called disciplina arcana. I think every listener can figure from that. Disciplina, there is a discipline, and arcana, it's arcane, the arcane discipline. That is, the early Christians living in their world halfway come of age are being, killed, persecuted by the emperor. They're surrounded by all other kinds of things. And how do you keep the story going? The bread and the wine of the Christian meal, the water of baptism, the parables of Jesus. Well, you don't take out commercials. You don't take out ads. You don't build big steeples. You don't say, we're better than you are, we're bigger than you are, we're mega church and you're a little church, or we got all the doctrines right and you don't. No, they had kind of a secret discipline. I don't mean it was like a fraternity or sorority so much that you have secret passwords, but you recognized by the language and the concern and the agenda and the action of the people with whom you were bonded that these meanings of God are active in your world.
Martin Marty, you know, we're talking about a very serious thinker who was always an activist and put activism first in a certain way. It's still moving to think of him leaving New York in the summer of 1939, returning to Germany on the last free transatlantic ocean liner before the war, knowing that he was sailing to his death, in effect, but having decided that the choice came down to bringing down the Third Reich or bringing down Christian civilization. And he said, I know which of these alternatives I must choose, but I cannot make that choice from security.
He knew what he was doing when he made this decision. There was no place to go except into the jaws of death. He didn't want to die. He did not have a martyr complex. In these letters he wrote from prison, he loves the world. He overhears a little music. He would hear a few lines of Hugo Distler or of Bach or a thrush outside the window. The window of his cell was too high for him to see out there, but he could hear that the thrush was there. So he really, really loved the world, and yet he's going back into it. And the way he put it was that Germany under Hitler, under the Nazis, is heading toward a tragic destiny, and if I don't suffer with the people, if I don't participate with that and then survive, I will have no right to have any credentials. So that's what he had to do. So the friends in America, when all that trouble comes, they arranged him to have a chair at a college in suburban Chicago, Elmhurst College. Not a large liberal arts college, but it had graduated the two, I think, greatest theologians of America in the 20th century, two brothers named Reinhold Niebuhr and H. Richard Niebuhr. And they lined up a job. You come here, you'll have an income, you'll have a place to hide, you can wait out the war. And it was only a couple of weeks till he knew he really had made a mistake and turned around. And I think that's another mark of the person, that that he knew what luxury and comfort could look like, but he didn't dare separate. He had a strong sense of the people. For him, the arcane discipline of the Christian community was always communal. He wasn't very much for what we would today call spirituality. You know, I'm not a part of any communion or fellowship. I'm very spiritual. We would call him spiritual, but what we mean by that today, I don't think characterized his life. In fact, he even had a phrase in one of his books, just about his first book, Christus existiert als Gemeinde, Christ exists as congregation. When you're there with the people with sweaty armpits and bad manners and garlic on their breath and they're worshiping and making sacrifices and bonding together, that's where Christ is. He said, that's where I'll be and that's where you find him. And to be in that prison deprived of that company was almost as bad as being deprived of all the other luxuries.
Martin Marty, I'd love you to speculate on not only why he is so resonant today, but what he would be saying to this world. What does Dietrich Bonhoeffer say to the scientific atheists of our time, like, say, Richard Dawkins, or the militant anti-religionists like Sam Harris? What would he say Richard Dawkins was missing in life?
I think he would say that Dawkins was reducing life to too narrow a dimension, just as a certain kind of Christian dimension does it when they're anti-science. Why do we make a boundary here? You're doing different vocabularies with different aims, but the heartiest scientists were often the people that loved life the way you're supposed to. They could be sacrificial, etc. So I think he would visit with them. Well, I think one thing he would say is you aren't going to achieve your program, Dr. Dawkins, by getting rid of religion. Mm-hmm. I think most of the people you referred to always imply that all the problems of the world come from religion, and as soon as you can get everybody to believe nothing, in that, then you'll have peace and all that. I think Bonhoeffer would say, well, look out the window. Adolf Hitler is not Orthodox Christian, but boy, he had Wotan, he had all the old gods, he had all of the myths and all that stuff, and generating a new myth along the way. In other words, he wasn't being sustained just by science. He had to deal with somehow with the dark demonic forces and the better angels of our nature and everything else. But I think he was very patient. He didn't have to remake everybody in order to deal with them.
Conversely, what would Dietrich Bonhoeffer say to the American religionists, the ardent religionists, the majority, and the power Christians especially, that we've come to associate in America with the Republican Party and the neoconservative foreign policy behind our wars today, even in the world of Islam? What would he be saying to the reigning and often silent Christian churches in America?
Well, I think he would say they aren't paying the cost of discipleship. Another one of his great books out of that hidden seminary, he calls Life Together. They're not living the life together. You might go through all the motions. Every time a space shuttle crashes or somebody gets assassinated, you run and fill the cathedrals and the churches for a week. You're not putting anything into it and get anything out of it. He'd sound like him a little bit, and he'd say, why don't you study the Bible? There's a lot of stuff in there that you're not paying attention to. I think if he had to pick a text from the Hebrew Scriptures, it would be Isaiah 58, which just matches very much what his message is for a place like America. Isaiah 58, the prophet is speaking for Yahweh, God, and God says, you know, the prophet says, Israel, you're complaining all the time. You are doing what God told you. You're fasting and you're praying, and yet bad things are happening. Why aren't you getting more out of it? And then God says, all right, I told you to fast. Now, this is my translation from the Hebrew, I have to admit. It's not elegant like King James. God says, you're going through all the motions. It doesn't mean anything at all. You fast. What happens when you fast? When you fast, you get hungry. When you get hungry, you get crabby. When you get crabby, you beat each other up. And he says, is that the kind of fast that I wanted? And then he lists, you could just about write both governmental and voluntary and churchly and private generosity and mercy into it. You claim all this, and yet people are unjustly imprisoned, and it doesn't bother you. You claim you want God down on your side, and widows and orphans are hungry and homeless and roofless, and it doesn't bother you. He goes on and on with all these. You don't even take care of your own relatives, says the prophet. And then speaking for God, God says, I'll tell you the kind of fast I want. It is to do that, to feed them, to cover them, and so on. And then beautiful words follow. You will be known as the builders of bridges, the restorer of bridges. You will be the people whose vineyards produce well, and so on. Well, that's almost quintessentially Bonhoeffer. God doesn't care that much. Bonhoeffer once quoted Martin Luther, and a lot of this is Luther, I have to say. Luther once said, God prefers the angry shout of the intense and passionate atheist to the wan, pious prattle of the half-believer. he needed the real stuff, and I think he would see that. Now, I think he'd see a lot of vitality, too. I don't want to undersell what goes on in American churches. When I say church, I mean synagogue and other place of worship. When the lights are turned out in the city at night, if somebody's taking care of homeless or feeding or AIDS or anything else, somehow or other, it's likely to be people who form religious communities and are moved by messages like Isaiah or the Christian gospel or plenty in the Quran. That's going on in thousands and thousands of places. But I think early on in this longer question, you kind of implied something I should jump into a bit more. The most intense, at least in the white and non-Hispanic community, of religious expression in our last couple of decades is not those that believe the world came of age, but the Pentecostals, the holiness people, for a while the fundamentalists, the evangelicals most of all, are people that have suddenly discovered Bonhoeffer. They were very suspicious of him because he wasn't orthodox in their way. A key teaching of the evangelicals for recent decades was that the Bible is inerrant, if the Bible says the world is made in 6 days, it was made in six 24-hour days. Well, he certainly didn't believe in inerrancy. He gave wonderful lectures on the first three chapters of Genesis that they wouldn't have liked. And so they didn't know quite what to make of him. But now recently, they're willing to look past some of these other things because they've needed heroes too. And he does have the basics down, the message of the love of God, of Jesus Christ, of the Holy Spirit, etc. But I think he'd be terribly upset by the materialism of much successful Christianity today, where it's true if it works. You're speaking the truth of God if you get big crowds, etc. I think there he'd do, again, he wouldn't head for our most prosperous suburbs and our biggest churches. He'd head right down into Harlem or west side of Chicago, where little storefront churches are surviving somehow. So I think he'd have a lot to say here today. We should never pin it down too much.
What would he be saying to this global Christianity that you referred to, expanding under many names and variations of belief in the poor and the brown world?
Yeah. Oh, I think he'd be very enthusiastic. He wanted to get to Mexico. He wanted to get to the poor world. I think his Harlem visits gave him an angle on it. I think he saw more authenticity there in his writings. You're ready for that along the way. I don't think he romanticized it. A lot of things go wrong there too. But the fact that Tanzania, with its little population, has almost as many Lutherans in 100 years as North America does with its big population in three centuries. So I think Bonhoeffer would say, I want to go down there and find out what's happening. Well, one thing that happens in those places, New Guinea's another place I've watched, they were brought up on the catechism, not the dull catechism that people thought was forced on them, but catechism translated into their world. And it gets pretty shocking until you get used to it. In New Guinea, for example, at the in the Mass, you don't sing, "Behold, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world." They don't know what a lamb is. What's their animal that gets sacrificed? "Behold, the pig of God." that's hard to take. I think Bonhoeffer would say that's the use of the imagination that we need to make the point of what sacrifice was about. Nobody should give a blanket endorsement to any place just because it's vital. Hitler's people were vital too, and they were all demonically wrong. But I think that you do put on different spectacles when you've gone through his picture of a world come of age and then how it's resisted. When you come across the man for others, I wrote a book a couple years ago on Christianity in the whole world, and I had to ask myself, what did they all hold in common in Tanzania and in East Harlem and in West Germany? And I think if you strain it down, they all believed that the human Jesus was the exalted Lord. They didn't ever agree on exactly what his humanity meant, and they certainly don't agree on what it all means, but exalted Lord, but they don't mean it was confined to be the nice guy. That doesn't last very long. Where he saw vital Christianity, Jesus was at the heart and the center of life, not at the edges. And I think that was a big part of what he was looking at.
Martin Marty, is there a fight worth having between liberals who cherish his activism and conservatives who cherish his orthodoxy? Do people want to scrap about that anymore?
I don't think they should have a fight. I think what we're needed between the different Bonhoeffer camps today and others is conversation, which is guided by the question. What can the evangelicals learn from Bonhoeffer's stark view of science? What can a cold fish mainline Protestant or a routine Catholic church learn from these Tanzanians and South Africans and Taiwanese, etc.? I've never heard anybody say, "We sure won that conversation." You say, I really learned something from that conversation. And there is a lot of that going on, so I wouldn't stimulate a war between the various factions. Yeah, theologians are going to fight about fine points of things. But as far as the larger church is concerned, and theologians are in that larger church, I think a lot of questioning is going on, and Bonhoeffer's a good opener when you want to address the questions.
You're a wonderful champion of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Martin Marty. It's such a pleasure to hear you talk about the man, virtually bring him alive. I hugely enjoyed your biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's last book, in a sense, The Inadvertent Letters and Papers from Prison. Thank you so much for this conversation.
I enjoyed being on Open Source.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.